Do you like veal, sweetbreads, or beef heart? Maybe beef tongue? That's certainly not common food in most grocery stores, and it may not be at all popular on restaurant menus anymore. Maybe you like to make tomato sauce at home and peel the tomatoes first. In either case, the common thread is blanching the food first. Blanching green beans to al dente was kind of a big thing in the 80s, and happily, we're beyond that. Do you blanch tomatoes before cooking them when you make a sauce? The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 258, Food and Freedom Once a Week for Life. Folks, Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the show. The Escoffier series continues in Chapter 7, The Principles of Cooking. Today, the focus is on blanching. Now, blanching isn't very complicated, so this isn't a particularly long episode, but there are a few important things to discuss. Escoffier identifies three uses of blanching: the offal meats, part cooking some vegetables and blanching other vegetables to the point really where it's boiling them so they are nearly fully cooked. Now, I mentioned sweetbreads at the opening. Veal sweetbreads are a real treat as far as I'm concerned. Sweetbreads have a process to follow before they are ready to cook again and eat. I mentioned beef heart at the top also. My mom used to make that in a crock pot. If you are in or around Michigan or are a fan of Coney Island hot dog chili, there's a better than even chance your chili has beef heart in it, or at least it used to. Beef heart is priced way, way out of my reach now, and back when my mom made it, it certainly was not priced out of reach. By the way, I know that it sounds, well, icky, yucky, gross. Beef heart's fantastic, and beef tongue, holy moly, that stuff is good, but that's another show. In the case of any meat, but mostly the offal meats, blanching is important to help remove the blood. Offal meats, yes, I know, it sounds like awful meats, are the organs, O-F-F-A-L. Usually sweetbreads, or sometimes it is the thymus gland, brains, heart, tongue, which, as I mentioned, is excellent, hooves or trotters, and pig head is most of the things that are on Escoffier's list. One of my stores does sell sheep tongue, maybe it's lamb, can't remember, but I bought them, and a very different texture than cow tongue, but very enjoyable. The versions of those meats, the offal meats in the grocery store, have almost certainly been as de-blooded, means rinsed and cleaned, as can be done in modern processing. In the case of sweetbreads and tongue, the other reason to blanch them is to help seize the outside of the meat, which makes the outside coating easier to remove. Now, on the tongue, you can follow me on this. Quite obviously, that's the taste buds and other stuff. And yes, I know that makes it an unsettling image. The sweetbreads have a very thin outer membrane that holds them all together. And if you leave that membrane on and cook them, the membrane gets kind of rubber bandy and it's not particularly enjoyable to eat. It's not overly bitter, but it doesn't have a lot of flavor. It's a texture thing. So blanch them, peel that off. Escoffier would say to shock them to stop the cooking, and when we used them in various restaurants, we never did that. Took them out of the pan, just let them cool enough in the pan, out of the water, on the counter, so they could be managed, being, you know, held to take the skin off the membrane. The next step, which is, now I don't, the next step is to press them. Now, I've seen places that don't do this, and I don't know that this is a rule as much as a personal preference. It might also be a place in time preference. The chef I worked for at the Ritz-Carlton Naples a long time ago was an old world French chef who insisted that the only way to process sweetbreads was blanch them, peel them, press them so that it's compacting the meat to give a better, firmer texture to the sweetbread, but also there is an aesthetic value to when you cut the sweetbread on the plate, everything looks nice. It's the same relative shape. So other places didn't do that, and I don't know. I don't know that one way is actually superior to the other. I think it's entirely preference. The unpressed sweetbreads tasted the same. As far as mouthfeel goes, I can't say that one was decidedly superior as a process over the other. I think it's entirely personal preference. Escoffier becomes quite stern in a few places in the book, and blanching meats for a blanquette or a fricassee is one such place where he becomes quite stern. He writes, quote, "Many people blanch meat and poultry when it is to be prepared for blanquette and fricassee. This is as great an error as that of soaking meat in cold water. If the meat or poultry being used is of good quality, and only good quality should be used, it is only necessary to place them in cold water or cold stock and bring them slowly to a boil." End quote. Now, blanquette de veau, which is a veal dish, blanquette is it's white, so it's a cream sauce finished with a liaison, which is egg yolks and cream to both. It thickens the sauce and adds a really velvety texture to it. If you find a place that serves that for lunch or dinner, get it because it's magnificent. Blanquette de veau, and we'll cover that when we get to chapter 13. It is a peasant dish. It utilizes less than preferred pieces of meat. But it's important to make the distinction that a subpar cut of meat isn't a de facto inferior cut of meat that Escoffier would warn us about using. It is still good quality. It just isn't something that's going to be center of the plate like a steak, like a filet or I don't like T-bone, but a T-bone or a porterhouse or something that is designed to be center of the plate, this is the thing you're buying. You can use good quality pieces of meat for a blanquette. It's just not the preferred cuts because they're tough and they have to do something with them. So you make a stew out of them. One key aspect to mention here is the blanching of meats for those dishes is the quality of the meat, not the cut, is the important part. I just mentioned that. I'm sort of stepping out of what I've written to make sure I don't miss points. No amount of soaking or blanching will turn a gray, inferior piece of meat into a better piece of meat. It just doesn't happen. So he also discusses the blanching of cockscomb, which, quite honestly, I've never once seen in the store. I don't have chicken, so this isn't something I've ever encountered. I'm not going to cover it. But I did find out, just sort of out of curiosity, by looking up chicken feet, there is actually no meat at all on a chicken's foot. Now, if you can correct me, that's fine. But this was Dr. Google giving me this. Well, that wasn't either. It was a website found by Dr. Google. But that's another show. Scoffier has a few observations about blanching vegetables. Green veggies, particularly old veggies, should be blanched to eliminate any bitterness. Now, before I continue, I think it's probably worth pointing out that the veggies we buy nowadays are probably younger in life than the veggies Escoffier had available to him in France. Now, I have no way of knowing this, and that may not be true at all. He may have made sure to get the youngest possible because they're going to taste better. But it's worth pointing out that there may be a change in the last 120 or 40, 60 years in gardening practices, both commercial and home, that alters the need for blanching old veggies, since we probably don't really have that many old veggies. He identifies particularly lettuce, chicory, celery, artichokes, and cabbage as requiring blanching. I'm sure the idea that lettuce needs blanching is an odd notion to most of you. It is probably so that no American, or very few, eat lettuce as a hot vegetable. Other vegetables he recommends that need blanching are carrots, turnips, and button onions, cucumbers for chow chow, which I find a curious addition in his French book, since it seems to me that chow chow is almost exclusively a Northeast U.S. thing, but obviously I am mistaken in that. To that part of blanching, but really it's boiling, he includes peas, French green beans, which I think here we call haricot vert, and Brussels sprouts and spinach. Now, personally, I don't blanch Brussels sprouts ever, depending on size, and I do prefer the little teeny ones. The closer to the size of a marble, the happier I am about it. Glaze them, brown them nicely in bacon fat, and sometimes also pieces of bacon. Finish them in the oven till they are squishy soft, which I'm the only one that likes them that soft. I want those things cooked. But I actually prefer the flavor of bitter. And I like that caramel umaminess that comes out of that deep roast. It's fantastic. And spinach. Now, this is back to that thing. It seems to me that most of the spinach we buy in bags in the store that has been triple washed is pretty young in as far as spinach leaves go. I've seen them get pretty big, and then they do get tough, and that's a whole other ballgame, and maybe that is the spinach he's talking about. For spinach, to me, it's always been a sauté from raw state thing, and then spinach really is made best with, near the end of cooking, a little bit of garlic, obviously salt and pepper. And then when it's done, maybe still in the pan, so the heat of the vegetable brings out the aroma of freshly grated nutmeg. Try that with your spinach, and it's a game changer of what fresh spinach can taste like. Vegetable cookery is chapter 13. I think I screwed that up and said that was meat with veal. So chapter 13, vegetable cookery, will cover veg cookery more there for the most part. I've been in no commercial kitchens, including the ones run by old-world classically trained chefs, where Escoffier's vegetable blanching concepts were carried out fully. No one blanched lettuce. If we extend the concept of lettuce a wee bit to include escarole, then we have a different conversation. Escarole, to me, is in the group commonly called bitter greens, which would include broccoli rabe. I think even though some of them aren't bitter, like mustard and turnip aren't particularly bitter, they're zippy at first. Kale, which I have a very low opinion of kale. But there's a few other ones that then we need blanching. Collards. Collards, they don't need blanching. Those things need 4 hours or 8 hours of boiling, but that's simmering. But that's so. There are some places where we are going to cook our greens pretty long. Now, escarole, I adore escarole. It is maybe one of my all-time favorite greens to eat. And since it's bitter, that makes me happier. Now, we did serve that at a restaurant I worked at, and there we did blanch it first and then got a good saute on it with some butter and a little bit of garlic. If you are cooking the blanched green vegetable right after blanching, that sounds kind of weird. I'm going to blanch it and then cook it. No extra step is required. Now, what does that mean? I mean, that sounds crazy, right? So you're going to blanch it to take some of the bitterness out. That's the whole point of putting in the water. And then, so you have on your stovetop, you have on the left side your pot of salted water, and you're blanching your cardoons or your celery. And then lift them out and put them into the saute pan to finish, and maybe you're making something with an eggplant, who knows? Eggplant and tomatoes and garlic would be good. That's a time when you would be blanching then cooking right away. If you're blanching to hold later for service later, maybe a big dinner, possibly Thanksgiving or Christmas, then refreshing them, that's the term that Escoffier uses, which means to plunge those hot green vegetables into an ice bath to stop the cooking. It also seals in that color, stops them in the process and keeps the color. So let's say instead of green bean casserole, or in addition to, who's not making green bean casserole? In addition to green bean casserole, you're going to serve nicely, green beans amandine. There we go. That's a good one. So you blanch your green beans, shock them, and then you hold on to the next day. So now service is moments away. You don't need that hot boiling pot of water. You've got these nicely blanched green beans. You've got your brown butter going. Add the almonds. Add your green beans to that. And then they will reheat and cook, and the almonds will toast nicely while all of that finishes together. Man, that's a nice, nice veg. So that would be a way, blanch today, serve tomorrow, saves you a few steps and saves you some time right there at the stove. Now, there is a caution about refreshing blanched vegetables. Root vegetables should not be refreshed. Carrots and potatoes and parsnips and turnips and rutabagas will absorb the cold water, making them waterlogged and diminishing the taste and the flavor, and it just kind of ruins the veg. Greens will go dull if overcooked, which is why we shock them in the water in the first place. It keeps that pretty green. So if you're blanching carrots, and you could do, let's say, in addition to your green bean casserole and your green beans amandine, you wanted to do a brown sugar ginger glazed carrot. Well, cut your carrots the way you want them and then blanch them to nearly done. Lift them out of the pan, out of the boiling water, and lay them out on a sheet pan or whatever you've got, as much of one layer as you can, and let them just cool at room temperature. You keep the color. They don't really overcook more than they were in the water. And then when they're cold, put them in a container, and then tomorrow, Thanksgiving, or whenever this meal is, as that caramel is working with the ginger, add the carrots to that, just like with the green beans. Adding them in the early stage of that caramel, the caramel will continue to make caramel, and the carrots will start to get hot and cook in that hot liquid, that hot caramel. Now you have a nice carrot dish. Now, I mentioned blanching tomatoes, which I almost always do if I'm going to make a sauce with them. Or at least I will cut the tomato into small wedges so I can kind of like fillet the skin off of the rest of the tomato. I don't care one teeny tiny bit for the thin paper-like skin in my food. I don't like that at all. So I blanch and peel cherry tomatoes for a pasta sauce. And that's kind of a lot of fun because they stay whole. And then when you bite into them, you get that hot tomato, whole tomato. It's a new look. It takes a few more steps. It's a bit of effort, but I I think it is entirely worth all the effort because of the payoff at the end is I don't have to fitz around with these stupid potato tomato skins. Now, many, many years ago, I remember when I was in high school and we had two pretty big gardens, we froze green beans from our garden. Doing that required blanching them. I don't recall the specifics, but I think we blanched them for probably 3 minutes, shocked them, then bagged them and froze them. And we had fresh green beans all winter long. And let me tell you, they were far superior to anything in the can and also superior to frozen from the store green beans. And a whole lot cheaper in terms of cash. Labor, not so much. One important aspect of blanching is to make sure you have plenty of water. Well, how much water is plenty of water? Six quarts at least, and salted well also. An important aspect of blanching is the water needs to remain as close to boiling as possible. It's fairly simple, actually. It's kind of basic math and physics. Put something at room temperature, do something boiling, and the temperature drops. The more water you have, the more mass of water at 212, the higher likelihood that the water keeps its temperature when you add something to it. Think about an ice cube in a bathtub. The water hardly changes. Now add 10 pounds of ice and you get a different result. Well, the same works with vegetables in water. Too many vegetables, and it is a surprisingly small amount of vegetables that makes a difference, the blanching stops and cooking starts. The blanching requires, for this process to work, requires 212, or if you're up at my height or higher, it's 206 here and less up high. But you need the boil to get that green color and to lock it in. If you're going below the boil, you're starting to cook, and then you lose that green color. That chlorophyll starts to cook out, and then you get this olive drab look. The other drawback is they will lose their crunch. Now, if it's escarole, that's fine. There is a way to keep your greens green, even when simmering. And I've not seen this mentioned anywhere, I think, for quite a while, for very good reasons, too. Baking soda in the water will keep your veggies green. There is a most unwelcome consequence to baking soda in water. The veggies turn slimy. We tested this at culinary school in the veg cookery class, and not a single person enjoyed the mouthfeel of slimy, brilliantly green beans. Looks pretty, tastes terrible. The only actual use I can think of for adding baking soda to water for green vegetables is a photo shoot. Something that no one's ever going to eat, because they do look great, but they are atrocious. So, oddly enough, that's it on blanching. It's very short. The primary uses for today would be for doing your vegetables in advance of a big meal when stove space is at a premium. Blanching tomatoes either for canning, and again, my preference is to eliminate the skins, for stewed tomatoes, and some recipes include leave the skins on, not for me, or peeling them because they make well. Again, it's the skin issue entirely, but also peeling them, they look different. There's an aesthetic value in the sauce with whole peeled cherry tomatoes, grape tomatoes, plum tomatoes, grape tomatoes. They look nice. It's worth a few steps of effort. And also for your off-all meats. And the last place for blanching, which I mentioned in stocks, is if for some reason your fridge management has gotten away from you and your chicken legs, chicken leg quarters, chicken wings, chicken bones are getting kind of rich, not gone, but getting kind of rich, a quick blend. Start in cold water, bring that to a boil, and give it a stir to loosen up all that protein on this on the outside that we want to get rid of. Skim the scum, and then now because it's going to have possibly some fat in there, and fat down the drain is a very bad idea, even if it's liquid fat. Pour that into a separate bowl that you can discard somewhere outside or feed to the dogs or discard outside. Then make your stock or boil your legs or whatever you're going to do. It's a that blanching process is a way to stop the pathogens, and that's what they are, from making more and making you sick. And you can sort of, now this is not the preferred method, but sometimes things get away from us. So we have to know how to respond, and that's one way to respond. All right, folks, that's going to do it. We have gratins, grilling, and deep frying yet to cover in this chapter. And quite frankly, I think deep frying will be fun. I think there's going to be some interesting things shared that maybe you didn't know about, and maybe you did. Gratins probably won't be much. I may add that with grilling, just because gratins, there's a few things to know about it, but it's not, I don't think, merits a show all by itself. A Twitter fellow with the handle Dad Chef posted a video of himself flipping an egg in one of those newfangled nonstick pans and suggested that no such thing could be done in a cast iron pan. So, of course, I did it. I'll post that video on the Patreon link to show it, I'll post that video on the Patreon and add a link to that video on the show notes page. It's the same video that I posted in the Twitter, but there's a real good chance you didn't see it because I know I get very little engagement. I get consistent engagement from the same people, and that's fine. I like seeing them, but Twitter doesn't seem to like me, and that's okay. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you being here. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.